You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to this Times Higher Education issue review podcast for the edition covering the 13th to the 19th of February 2014. My name is Chris Parr. I'm joined by news editor Simon Baker, reporter Jack Grove, editor John Gill and editorial assistant John Elms. I should flag up at this point that our books editor Karen Shook has a special books podcast out this week too. It's an interview with Philip Roscoe, author of this week's book of the week, I Spend, Therefore I Am. It's reviewed on page 46 and a podcast is due out on Friday the 14th, so you'll get that where you found this. Anyway, back to this week's podcast. Are so-called elite universities as socially exclusive as they ever were? A report by the Office for Fair Access suggests that they are. More on that in a second. The long-awaited grant letter finally appeared earlier this week, detailing government funding for higher education. Simon has a bit on what it meant for a news editor at the time when such a large announcement is made. John Elms will talk a bit about HE and Me, a section that started late last year, features Q&As with some prominent HE figures. They've been very popular so far. And our cover feature this week is on Germany's U-turn on tuition fees. They were introduced in 2006, set to be abolished by the end of the year, and John Gill will tell us a bit more about that. But first of all, Jack, you had the lead news story this week, a report from the Office for Fair Access. What does it tell us?
This is a report about the social makeup of our universities and whether that makeup has changed over the last 15 years. And at the most selective universities, it hasn't really changed at all. Only 2.9% of the poorest 40% of 18-year-olds go on to the top universities, the high-tariff universities, and that is only 0.5% higher than in 1998. And this comes despite the fact that universities have spent hundreds of millions of pounds over this period, and essentially, the social makeup of the universities hasn't really changed very much. So, I mean, I think this could be a good opportunity to ask whether whether universities are on the right track when it comes to their approach to outreach. And this report also points out that lots of the heavy lifting in terms of university access and social mobility and getting first-generation students whose parents haven't been to university and people who come from poorer backgrounds, most of the heavy lifting has been done by lower and middle tariff institutions. And these universities are the ones who are really in line for some of the cuts that are coming up this year. So people are asking whether these universities are getting enough credit for the work that they've been doing, whilst the elite universities, whose research money has been protected, seem to be getting off quite lightly.
Yeah, I mean, hundreds of millions of pounds on bursaries and outreach. I mean, the question has to be asked where that money's going, doesn't it? I mean, why has it been so misspent as to have little or no effect, certainly, you know, according to the report published this week?
Well, I mean, it probably has had some effect. I mean, there are more students going to university now than there were in the 90s. So there has, overall, the numbers of poor students have gone up, but actually, this report points out that it's actually the middle classes who've benefited most from the expansion of student places. These, the more prosperous, affluent middle classes are the ones who've seen their acceptance rates into the top universities go up. So, I mean, it does raise a question about what the sort of top... I mean, I think Britain over the last 15 years, there's been a huge increase in participation, but people are wondering whether the participation is only happening at certain sort of lower, less prestigious universities, and at the top end hasn't really changed very much. I mean, for one institution that's not named, rich students are 16 times more likely to go to that university than poorer students.
I think what's interesting about this is when you combine it with, there's another story in this issue as well, it's worth looking at, about that shows that students from ethnic minorities and from London are more likely to sort of get the grades and go to university than white students, or especially white students from outside London. And I think what that kind of suggests is that over the last 15, 20 years, there's been a lot of concentration on, when we're talking about getting more people to go to university from poorer backgrounds, the inner city, and particularly London, and that I think there needs to be more work maybe done on people from poorer backgrounds, from rural areas possibly. That's where there is a mismatch.
Also, there's a mention of this in our cover feature this week, which we'll talk about later, and it isn't specifically on this topic, but that feature, which is by Howard Hodgson, who's Professor of Early Modern Intellectual History at the University of Oxford, he talks about the way that the class system and so on affect our attitudes to education, and says that England has the most extravagant provision of elite private schooling and some of the lowest levels of social mobility in the developed world, and he quotes OECD statistics to kind of back this up. So it's one of those topics, isn't it, that we touch on all the time in all sorts of ways. So to have some figures from Offa flagging this up and giving us some hard data is quite interesting.
Although apparently there has been some improvement since 2011, since £9,000 tuition fees has come in bizarrely. Apparently, the number of poorer students going to the top universities has increased by about a quarter. So, I mean, that seems bizarre to me. But
and that's a period
happened.
A period not covered by the report as well. So, something that we'll report on going forward. But you had mentioned there, Jack, the cuts this week. Of course, the grant letter finally arrived. I say finally. I think it's the latest publication of the grant letter that we've ever seen. We've had lots of coverage online, and we live tweeted it when it dropped into our inboxes as well. But Simon, I mean, maybe you can just give us a sort of sense of you know what it's like in a newsroom when such a piece of information arrives and it has to be put into the magazine. We have to get it up on the website as quickly as possible because it's not the clearest document ever published, is it?
Well, no, I mean, the grant letter, I mean, this is quite a special case, really, because, you know, the grant letter comes, as the fourth one I've dealt with, well, being at THE, both as a reporter and a news editor. And the strange thing about the grant letter is, as you know, it's coming. It's like most of the time. I mean, I think there was a year before I started where it suddenly came out of the blue just before Christmas when Mandelson announced some cuts. But, I mean, most of the time you kind of have this trail, you know it's coming, and you're kind of like in this fevered state of anticipation, waiting for you. Okay, maybe I am. Yeah, maybe just me. But obviously, the rumours fly around. This might be cut. This might be cut. And so you're kind of waiting for this document. And bizarre, with the strange thing with this grant letter is that this carried on for weeks. Yeah. Really, literally 4 or 5, maybe 6 weeks, where we thought it might be. And every week, we have to sort of plan the magazine. We sort of go to press on a Tuesday. The magazine comes out on a Thursday. You have this kind of day in between where the grant letter could arrive, but we can't really cover it in the magazine. So you're kind of worried about that every week. And you want to cover what's going on with all the political kind of infighting around the grant letter, but then you're worried it might suddenly arrive at some time. So there's that difficulty to deal with. But yeah, when it does arrive, you're sort of basically get this document which has lots of figures in that are dressed up in different ways every time, and you know that they total things up in very strange ways. You've got to kind of try and very quickly make sense of it. But in terms of transparency, this is probably one of the most difficult grant letters I've seen to understand. And for a government that was supposed to be making things more transparent, it really doesn't give much. It proved very difficult to kind of get to the bottom of exactly what was going on here. In the end, the simplest way to do it is take last year's grant letter, look at what they said the budget would be, look at this year's, okay, and there's been a cut of over 100 million. But if you actually start to drill down into how things are added up and what kind of pot of funding these things have been distributed in, it's actually quite difficult to make sense of. And
it's never as clear as well, is it? I mean, it's not one of those documents where they say, give very precise details about exactly what is necessarily exactly what money's being cut from where. So the buck is being passed to a certain extent to Hefke to actually implement the cuts and decide what how to kind of
that's part of the problem is the grant letter is officially a direct a document that directs Hefke on what areas to prioritise. It doesn't say you will cut this and you will give this much money to poorer students, this much money to science subjects. It kind of directs them in language and gives them an overall pot of money, and then Hefke decides. So you know, the real kind of information on how this will be broken down will probably come after Hefke have decided how to break it up.
I think one of the things I find interesting with the Grant letter is the way they sort of throw in a bit of commentary about things that really they've got absolutely no control over. Like this year they mentioned Vice-Chancellor's pay, or actually pay across the sector, which would have been a sort of bittersweet reference for people on the pay dispute at the moment. Because on the one hand they were saying, you know, senior executive pay is rising too quickly and we're very concerned about it, and you should bear in mind that this is obviously an issue in at a time when pay in general should be being held down. So you had the situation where you've got two biz ministers you know, having a bit of a go at pay when actually they've got very little leverage or control over what remuneration committees do. And actually some might say, you know, they've actually been you know, championing market forces in higher education and saying that the market works and finds its own level. And to a certain extent, that's the same argument that's employed by universities when they say that we have to pay for the best and brightest. You know, they sort of recycle this line that's used by banks when they say they're in a global competition for talent, etc., etc. So it's one of those slightly weird documents where they, you know, there is a lot of detail in there, but there's also some sort of throwaway references that are slightly beside the point.
Yeah, they make political statements, but at the end of the day, the Grant letter just belies the fact that the government really doesn't have direct control over what universities do.
What they spend the money on.
No.
Indeed. Well, the coverage of both the offer report and the Grant letter on page 6 and 7 this week. Now, John Elms, you sort of take charge of one of our newer sections in the magazine called HE and Me.
I do.
It's been around for a little while. Basically, key figures from HE answering a Q&A. What have been your sort of highlights so far on that particular column?
Well, you're right, Chris, to say key figures. I mean, we do want to have the most interesting people. I mean, not to say there aren't interesting people in the HE world, but
they're all fascinating.
The most interesting people, but it's not just key figures. We do have a broad range of people wanting to be interviewed, and also us wanting to interview them. I mean, I've interviewed so many different people from all manners of areas of.
Come on, Hanif Qureshi. Let's get that.
So what John is referring to there is my most notorious and possibly most successful interviewee, the author Hanif Qureshi, who was made a professor of creative writing at Kingston University. And it was an extraordinary case because I had to do it over the phone. It's usually best done in emails.
Probably the first and last time we did that, but at the same time, the results were
spectacular. It was a tough interview, to say the least. I mean, at one point he did say to me, "I can't believe you can't think of better questions than this, dude. I really can't." At which point I said, "Well, I think I've got everything I need. Goodbye." And that was a good way to end the interview. In the same interview, I also asked him, "What are your biggest regrets?" And he said, "Well, lots of things, but I'm not telling you."
Really, really good stuff for a column where you need to you need to hit a certain workout.
Well, in actual fact, you know, those are kind of the better answers, because at least that's someone who's taking these questions at face value.
You would have been disappointed if he hadn't torn a shred off you.
Oh no, absolutely. Of course, you know, that was great. You know, and it provided a lot of interest in on the Twitter sphere and social media for the column. I mean, you know, we've had all sorts of people. One of our first ones was Sir Paul Nurse. You know, the noted Nobel Crick Institute. Yeah, we've had Jonathan Powell, one of my favourites, who was Tony Blair's former chief of staff and the principal negotiator in the peace process. He gave some really candid personal stories of his involvement in the peace process, which
in Northern Ireland,
of course. Yes, that's what I'm talking about.
We also had Nick Hillman revealing that David Willetts has a pair of silver party shoes, which was a personal favourite. They were all online, those ones, but tell us who's in this week.
Well, to go back to the point that we don't just pick people who are, you know, everyone knows about. Our current HE and Me is Tony Spurgeon, who recently was awarded his doctorate from City University, and I know a lot of people get doctorates, but he at 83 is what City believes their oldest graduate, and he provided some quite interesting answers when he did his first undergraduate degree. The the news headline at the time was the Korean War, not many of our listeners might have been privy to. And you know, he provided perspective that on HE from, you know, back in the day before we even had podcasts. So you know, we have lots of different interviewees and from all, you know, ends of the spectrum.
And we've got the editor here, John. I mean, who's next? Who's
ideal? Well, I did say to John the other day that I said that I wanted an A-list star. Make it so. And that's all I'll say about that.
So A-list
star. There's a hint in there.
We'll leave it there.
A very, very, very subtle hint.
Indeed. Well, keep an eye on that column, or that section, I should say, for the A-list star. This week's cover feature is, as we previously mentioned, by Professor Howard Hodgson, Professor of Early Modern Intellectual History at the University of Oxford. John Gill, over to you. What's this all about? What's he writing about this week?
Well, I mean, Howard has been one of the sort of at the forefront of the campaign to protect the idea of the public university, and has written before very powerfully for us and others about some of the issues that he sees with the sort of neoliberal idea as it creeps into higher education, and the marketisation of higher education and the sort of fetishisation of private good as opposed to the public good and so on. And he's written a really fascinating piece for us this week about what's happened in Germany, where some years ago they decided to introduce fees. They were slightly late to the party, but they brought them in around 2006 or 2007. In 7 out of the 10 states in West Germany. And slowly, for a variety of reasons, those states have actually overturned the original decisions. And what were relatively small tuition fees of around €1,000 have been phased out. And by the end of this year, the only state that's still charging fees, Lower Saxony, will cease to do so. So this is a really interesting case study of a European power that has sort of come to the late to the party, introduced fees as we have here, obviously, and then decided that actually it's not the right thing and is phasing them out, which is something that at the moment in this country you just can't see happening. And Howard Hodgson sort of looks at why it's happened in Germany, how the sort of democratic process has allowed students and others who felt very aggrieved at the introduction of fees to reverse that decision, and why it hasn't happened here, because of course there has been a big outcry over the last few years. You know, you had one of the largest student protests in living memory, and Westminster, after a little bit of kettling and so on, sort of ignored it. It really, you know, democracy didn't play its role there. So he talks a lot about the reasons for that, and it's really fascinating. He goes back, being a history professor, he goes back and looks at the way that Germany has developed over the last 500, 600, 700 years, and the fact that it's been a federal entity, and that a lot of the universities date from the 14th century, when leading princes in the Holy Roman Empire wanted to sort of set up their own local universities to train, you know, noblemen and clergy and so on. And he describes a country where you've got the German states that feel very loyal and have a lot invested in their local university, very historic universities, in a way that he says just doesn't happen here in this country. So you get local democracy playing a really big role in the way those institutions are funded. And he really argues that that's one of the key differences in the way that the tuition fee U-turn really in Germany has played out. But I mean, there's much more to it than that. I'm being quite reductive. But it's a really fascinating study when you think of us being in a situation where, in all honesty, you know, for all the concern that there is both within the academy and outside it about the level of tuition fees, it's very hard to see that being reversed anytime soon. But
well, the exact opposite. I mean, we covered people sort of predicting, you know, £20,000 fees for certain institutions for domestic students. We've seen everyone hit 9K and now asking questions about inflationary rises, meaning surely that cap's got to be lifted. You hear far less about
suggesting that we're looking more across to the states than we are to our European neighbours. But no, it's a fascinating piece, really, really interesting, and I think, you know, I'd strongly recommend it to anybody who has, you know, would like to understand a bit more about the European situation and how things have unfolded there.
I suppose we did. I mean, in this country, we did have a local democratic link to some higher education institutions when we had polytechnics, but of course that changed when because polytechnics were linked to local education authorities, weren't they? So But I suppose that changed as soon as they got rid of the binary divide. And
another interesting difference is that Germany doesn't... I don't think Germany charges tuition fees for international students in the same way as well. They're very keen to have them international students in just because they want them for their labour force, rather than seeing them as cash cows to prop up the finances of university. Another very interesting difference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, indeed. Read all about that on page 36, I think, this week. That's all for this week's podcast. You can talk about anything you've heard in this episode on our website. You're always welcome to comment on there. You'll find us on Twitter at Times Higher Ed. We're on LinkedIn, we're on Facebook, we're on Google+. So if you've anything to say, do get in touch. But that's all for this week's Times Higher Education Issue Review Podcast.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.